Hello, everyone. School for Startups Radio. We are so cram-packed, we don't have time for our normal introduction. We have to get with it. We have Wayne Elliott, our favorite Canadian entrepreneur, with us. But first, we have Jennifer Knuckles running an incredible new environmental business. It is Thursday, the 10th of October, my 15th wedding anniversary. Congratulations to us. But we're cram-packed, no time to talk about it. Let's get started with the show. Here we go. Very excited to introduce another great guest in our environmental series. Please welcome Jennifer Knuckles to the show. She is the chairperson and CEO of R0. It is a San Francisco-based company that is involved in planning interior spaces so that you get optimum productivity and also, more importantly, reduced energy costs. They have been leading that space for quite a few years and also offer chemical cleaning solutions, the aerosol disinfectant things to kill all of the COVID and stuff like that. Jennifer's had a very interesting career, worked her way up at the Clorox company. So you probably bought a lot of her cleaning supplies. Then she was chief marketing officer at Zynga. We all remember them. And then at SoFi, she was an executive vice president, and now she is the CEO. Welcome, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Tim, for having me this morning.
We're excited to learn about all of these great environmental companies out there saving the environment for us. Tell us about R0.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much. So R0 offers a comprehensive smart buildings platform. I know that's a mouthful, so here's what I'll say. We help building owners and operators solve their top challenges by making their building data useful. So what do I mean by that? Think about all the information that we all have in our houses. The idea of smart homes is not new. The idea of smart buildings, actually buildings aren't as smart as you would believe. So think about the ventilation and the lighting and the energy consumption of office buildings and schools and hospitals that we all frequent. We help our customers optimize 65 to 90% of all of their energy consumption while not sacrificing building codes, occupant health and comfort, and performance of the space.
Wow, very cool. All right. So who is your bread and butter client? You mentioned hospitals, schools. I would think that it would be new skyscrapers and things like that.
Is it
all of the above?
You're right. It's 100%. It's commercial real estate. So if you think about humans, we spend 90% of our time indoors. And certainly in those large skyscrapers that you're speaking to, those are optimized for productivity of the workforce. So how people move through the spaces, what floors you're congregating on, what services are provided, what the optimal space layout looks like. There's a number of things that are happening in both the federal and at the state level, which I think you and I both appreciate, that are really drawing attention to the performance of these buildings, how much greenhouse gas is being emitted, what the energy usage is being used, the primary uses of building spaces. HVAC systems account for 40 to 50% of the energy. Lighting is up to 25%. Office equipment, which is like computers, printers, copiers, that type of stuff, 20%. Water heating is 10%. So these buildings cost an enormous amount of money to run, which is important because energy costs have risen, but they also emit a ton of emissions and pollution and impact to our environment and the world we all live in.
Yes. So let's start sort of at the macro level. Your customers are freaking out because their buildings are not worth what they used to be because they don't want to work 100%. At home now, right? Is that a fair description?
100%.
Of the macro?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, look, I live in San Francisco. San Francisco has certainly taken the brunt of it. I think New York is also seeing, the flight to quality, if you will. The flight to quality is real. So building owner operators, REITs that have the Class A buildings are really benefiting, and they're looking to either optimize the lease holdings or optimize the price per square footage. So that's on the owner side. When you think about the tenant side, large companies, Fortune 500 companies, are looking for the optimal space configuration of their of the real estate they hold. Many companies are locked into 20-year leases, so they can't vacate those leases. Many companies are looking to downsize their footprints, but mostly people are looking to get the optimal use out of the spaces, meaning if you have a 20-story skyscraper, how should you use each one of the stories? And is that collaboration spaces? Is it cafeteria spaces? Is it subleases? Is it office space versus open plan? And this data really doesn't exist in the buildings today, let alone it doesn't integrate within the building management system, which we provide the middleware layer that allows that to happen.
All right. So if I were to hire you for my building, and let's say it's a 1990s construction, yeah, what kind of savings do you think that you could provide for that building? You know,
Yeah. 28% energy savings. That's proven by the case studies that we've run at very large scale office buildings. So if you think about your point about a 1990s office building, the majority of buildings in the US are existing retrofits. There's much more existing real estate than there is in new builds. So from a new build perspective, obviously, you know, the architects, the building owners are looking for the latest technology when you plan out the buildings. Many of the older buildings don't have that. And so they all, if a building's over 50,000 square feet, they use a building management system like a Siemens, a Honeywell, and those are the systems that, you know, work with the HVAC system. What they don't do is work with the number of people in the building, how the people are using the space, which floors should not be lit. These buildings are very like blunt instruments, meaning air conditioning runs 24/7, or if they're, you know, trying to be savvy, they turned on 2 hours before the building is occupied. In more differentiated climates, like areas where it's warmer in the summer and really cold in the winter, that costs an enormous amount of energy because you're heating the buildings when you don't need to be. And this is all coming to a head because many states have required net zero by 2030, which is only 5 years from now. And Local Law 97 in New York City is leading the way. There will be penalties against all of the building owners and building providers who don't get to net zero by 2030.
Well, how can they? How can they make the Empire State Building net zero?
Yeah, you know, it's not a silver bullet, right? You need a lot of different components working together. So whereas we can save 28% off of the energy costs by using a variety of products that we have available on market, we have smart filtration, which allows for less energy draw within the air handling units. We have occupancy-based demand control ventilation, which means that the HVAC and the lighting is only used when the buildings are actually occupied. Occupied based on like by the minute presence detection, not, you know, badge swipes. So all of these different components add up to help the building provider, but the building provider needs to take steps now or they're just going to incur the penalties. You know, this also becomes really important as you think about who invests in the properties. So it's, you know, limited partners invest in the properties and they have their own ESG goals that they're adhering to.
Right. Fascinating. So give us a scale. You're what, 100 person, 150 person business?
Yeah. We're about 4 years old. We're venture backed. We've raised just under $200 million in venture funding. Our venture investors are some of the leading in the world, as well as Silicon Valley. So we have DBL, which is Double Bottom Line. They invest in sustainable businesses. Most notably, they are the investors behind, early investors behind SpaceX and Tesla. We have World Innovation Lab, which is the Japanese sovereign fund. Japan often leads in technical innovation with some of their large built environments. We have CDPQ, which is the Canadian pension fund, the largest pension fund out of Canada. So we have a number of very large, influential investors who are, you know, looking to develop long-term sustainable companies that help the common good, right? I think if you have the ability to commercialize and also do things that are better for people, it's kind of a win-win. So yeah, we have about 100 people. We are located predominantly in the Bay Area. Of course, we have our solutions engineers and our sales team that is throughout the United States. We produce our hardware here in the U.S. as well as some offshore, and then our software capabilities are all developed here out of the Bay Area. And we have, you know, very notable clients. We have four out of the Fortune 10. We have a lot of the large technology firms here, whether it's Indeed, Salesforce, LinkedIn, Meta, you know, large real estate footprints that are also focused on the cost of the buildings and the cost of the human capital. You know, our predominant investment goes behind software and, you know, why I think our core values, we lead by the customer, what matters to the customer. So really making sure that we work with the customers to identify the problems that they are trying to solve. Oh, I can speak to that a little bit. The key challenges that our customers are looking to overcome, the first is, I would say, interoperability. So buildings have so much data, as I mentioned, and much of that is requiring manual analysis to extract any value. And so we provide more simplified, centralized tools that allow the building owners to aggregate and do the analysis and then provide the insights. And then the next big challenge that we allow for is automation. So building owners and operators can automate based on the real-time data. And this is in terms of like how their building controls work, how they're changing actual real-time use of energy. So it's by the minute.
Very cool. And you've been there for about 4 years too. So were you the original CEO, Jennifer?
No, I wasn't. So I took the CEO seat 2 years ago. I was on the board since inception. So as you mentioned, I was one of three EVPs at SoFi. I did that IPO 4 years ago. I was running a third of the company. So I had a really big seat, you know, a lot of people, 4,500 people, big P&L, and
you got a stadium named after you, for God's
sake. We did.
And it's absolutely a beautiful building too. I give it a
wonderful stadium.
Beautiful.
Absolutely. Super Bowl, very fun. One of my best experiences. So I love SoFi. It was obviously a very hard role to leave. When I think about what's important to me, I think about three things, digital health, the environment, and education. So I had served on the R0 board as the only independent board member, and they were looking to bring in a go-to-market leader who knew how to scale. And just in terms of my background, they went through a pretty in-depth search. It was complimentary, kept coming back to me, but I had this big seat that I was reticent to leave. But I think when it comes down to it, you think about what do you want to do in life and what really matters. There's really nothing more than matters than the environment. If we don't improve the world we all live in, there is no world for our children, for our grandchildren, for our great-grandchildren. So that was why I made that decision. So I've had 4 years with the company, but 2 years in the CEO seat.
All right. Very interesting. Who, Jennifer, is going to solve the global climate change problems? Is it the academics in Cambridge or the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley? Who's going to be more responsible?
I appreciate that question, Jim. I was an academic in Cambridge. I went to Harvard. I worked out of Silicon Valley for the past 20 years. So I think it's not one or the other. I think everyone has to solve these problems. What I mean by that is there's been a number of academic studies that have existed for decades. By the way, R0 has commissioned several academic studies, inclusive of some of our built-in hardware that goes into the buildings. And we've run these out of established universities, Columbia, Harvard, University of Minnesota, so that we have the academic proof points. That being said, you need real-world applications. One real-world application is the government, the federal government, the GSA. We are on the GSA. We are partnering with state and local governments. We have city of Oakland. We have Los Angeles, a big execution through, but it can't be done just at the government level. Government certainly owns a huge footprint of real estate. The innovation is coming from the private sector. Innovation in the private sector moves much more quickly than the public sector. There's a lot of things we ask startup entrepreneurs to do, many of which are Heroclian efforts. And I think you need that agility and speed that comes with asking like what's possible and pushing the boundaries. And then you partner with the established organizations that have, you know, legacy tenure and large footprints to actually commercialize out of.
I would take it a step further and say that academia is spending too much time fighting amongst itself, looking at its navel, arguing about things that are irrelevant, and not enough time actually coming up with solutions to our problems.
I feel like we all like live and breathe a feeling of that, right? Like the fight is on the outside. It's not on the inside. I say that to my teams all the time. Like when you're doing hard things.
I don't understand what you mean. Inside, outside, what I get.
Like with academia is fighting amongst itself, like they should actually be fighting against what we need to fight in the world. What do we need to fight in the world? The fact that our like planet is overheating, the water sources are decreasing. We're going to end up having new oxygen sources because there's not enough fresh air to breathe. We all became intimately aware of like just how deadly things can spread over the past 4 years. Like that's a macro fight, right? If you're staring at your navel and fighting as to like who's publishing or what resources go against what paper, you're kind of missing the big point. And I think that's true at companies as well. There's so many skunk works team that are intimately focused on their own resources that if you take a step back and say like, what are we trying to solve in the world together? What is that saying, Jim? It's like all boats rise with the same tide. Like we should all live that in our lives.
Yes. And how much oversight do you get from the venture capitalist, right? One of the premises of the show is that they should be renamed the vulture capitalist. You know, we like all of those stereotypes here. Those are all embraced. A lot of our guests have lived through those. I've lived through those. What's your experience been? It seems like you're a little bit more of an insider all in the beginning, and I don't know, what's your experience been with the
VCs? It's funny. So I, as you mentioned, after business school, I worked at Clorox for a decade. Clorox is a large public company. It's been around for 130 years. The venture community isn't as relevant. After that, I went to a series of venture-backed startups, including Zynga, which IPO'd, or Zynga primary investor was Kleiner Perkins. So I know John Doerr, who's a big investor in the environment. John actually put money into R0 because he believes in what we're doing and, again, how we're benefiting the environment. So that was kind of my first experience at the large venture level. Similarly with SoFi, SoFi was private before I joined. Our large investments were Silver Lake and SoftBank. And so I've sat in the boardroom now for the past, 20 years. And boards are, they kind of have three roles, right? Number one is like strategic oversight. Number two is like door openings. And then number three is like leadership, making sure you have the right people in seats. And I think sometimes, unfortunately, you end up with like pretty apathetic boards. Sometimes you end up with boards that have differing incentives, especially in the venture community. If they're looking to maintain their 40x return, they want to do it in the standard 7 years. I think I'm very fortunate at the R0 level because I have a board that is truly focused on developing long-term important companies. And we've seen this in the nature of the companies they've backed and how these companies have exited and grown into very large players. So I feel like I have less of a short-term focus from my investors, which make it a lot easier to develop the right products and not take shortcuts. That being said, especially the market dislocation that we've all seen, which maybe early signs were coming out of, cash is certainly king. I raised $105 million not that long ago, which I'm pretty proud that we did, but I certainly preserve that cash. And I maintain that I treat it as I would treat my own. If I wouldn't spend my own money this way, I certainly wouldn't spend my investors' money that way. I think that's where sometimes some of the butting heads between the vulture capitalists and the entrepreneurs come to play.
Yes. What about all of the new data centers and the new, just all of the new demand for energy?
Yeah,
how
really
are we
important,
going to come
right?
to terms with that? We're nowhere close to what we need.
You know, there was an article that just came out this morning about Southern California's hottest commercial real estate market is for tenants that aren't human. So it's exactly this point. The AI centers are real, and the amount of energy consumption is unfathomable. You know, we've all, especially in California, we live through when the grid gets too overused and we have these rolling blackouts. Like, we're going to start facing this. R0 has a data center product available because those centers get too hot, actually temperature wise, and they are using too much energy. So this again goes back to my point that there's not one silver bullet. You need a combination of many different types of solutions. The two that we have for data centers are, again, for reduction in pulling of outside air and pressure drop, as well as reducing the actual energy that's used on an ongoing basis. I think there have to be many solutions like this that will come into play. And there's a number of large providers that, you know, are, this is top of mind for them, and they need to fix.
And how long until you add a residential division, and what would that look like? I believe in the environment. I want to play my tiny little part. And so I got the, what's it called? The air conditioner, the Nest thing.
Yeah, of course.
I can't stand it. I can't stand
really?
It. You know, I'm always freezing cold. I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm wearing a sweater in the middle of summer in my own house. And that's what they tell me is the best policy.
Okay.
And I'm freezing.
Wait, so you live in one of those wildly changing climates I mentioned. It's either too hot or too cold. So I also have a Nest. I think Google, with the acquisition of Nest, has done a very good job in establishing the idea of the smart home, as I mentioned. And there's a ton of things that are involved with that, whether it's smart locks and, cameras, whatever, your doorbell. I think as you think about the ventilation, one thing that's going wrong in your home, Jim, is the machine learning model. So our machine learning model, we have hundreds of millions of points of code and data points. We're constantly training the model so that, for example, in the commercial space, the safety lights at the floor of a hospital go on when someone's walking through, not just at a certain time per day, or when there's a difference in traffic. So they, you know, are a different level of brightness based on the number of people. That model is really important. What you need to do in your home is you need to make sure on the times of the day when you're recording your radio segment that you're in the room that you want to be in, and your house is recognizing that. The problem with a house, though, is it is a blunt tool. You're not going to have subzones so that your office is different than the kitchen. That's actually the problem with a lot of large real estate, is that, again, it's a blunt tool, and floor 20 is cooled at the same as floor 2, even though there's no one on floor 20. And this is what R0 actually allows us to do, is work with the buildings and control at the floor, room, building, portfolio level so every tenant can do their part. At the residential level, we actually do have residential SKUs. We have residential SKUs on our UVC products, which you had mentioned earlier at the top of the hour. We also have residential SKUs on the smart filtration, you know, those filters that you go to Home Depot or Ace and swap out every quarter. We have products that are available as well for the home. And then our machine learning model will be available next year in the home as well.
All right. Totally off topic, though. I have a feeling you'll have an opinion. What about the new Leaning Tower of San Francisco? What do you all
I have
do
a very strong. I have a very strong opinion on that because I have a very good girlfriend who owns one of the units.
She's lost a ton of money, it looks like.
He has lost a ton of money. So these are units that, I don't know, 10 years, 8 years ago, you bought for multiple millions of dollars, had a view, 360 degree view of the city, amazing at Millennium Tower. You know, Salesforce went up. The tower, as you all know, is now being held up by a crane. It is sinking small amounts, you know, fractions of inches into the ground on a daily basis. And what this results in is the top of the building, where her kitchen is, having a 6-inch crack running through the kitchen. You can't sell the property. You can't live in the property, or you wouldn't want to live in the property. And it is very slowly sinking. And yes, it needs to be retrofitted and not held up by a crane.
Well, they've tried to retrofit, from what I understand. I know. It made it worse, from what I understand.
It did. Mm-hmm. Leaning at an even stronger degree. Mm-hmm.
So what's the solution? You have to tear it down, don't you?
Now, San Francisco is tricky. I don't know from a structural engineering standpoint what you need to do, but San Francisco is tricky because a lot of the property is built on landfills. And Boston has done the same thing. When I was in school, there was this thing called the Big Dig. Now it's the beautiful waterfront in Boston, but it's basically, you know, dirt that's brought in from the harbor to prop up a neighborhood. And San Francisco has a lot of that in the marina area, the beautiful water views. Essentially on a peninsula, or you know, a mini island, if you will. So I think this kind of goes to our point about retrofitting. And when you look at how a building is performing, you know, the idea of a smart building and good for its inhabitants, health, comfort, experience, really important. We can't just do aesthetics. We have to make sure that the building is actually not compromising, you know, overall experiences of its inhabitants.
Here in Atlanta, just this week, they announced the Georgia Pacific Tower, which I think is 62 stories. They're going to retrofit the top 10 stores and make them stories and make them residential.
Yeah.
Which I think is just a fascinating idea. You know, it's a thin tower, so I think the footprint would be conducive to that. But a lot of the towers with these huge open air footprints that the developers wanted 40 years ago, you're not going to be able to make into condos and apartments. So I can't wait to see what you do with them. So,
you know, I was in London a couple of weeks ago at PropTech getting a couple of presentations. It's a very large real estate conference. And across the bay was a new banking facility, the Citibank Tower, that's doing the same thing that you're speaking to for Georgia Pacific, and retrofitting a decades-old building and using the space in a different configuration to be used for commercial versus residential, for mixed use. You know, the footprint of buildings internationally has definitely changed, and the past 5 years has exacerbated that because people are living in different places and expecting more from their built environment. So it's allowing for like optimal configurations, and I think everyone's kind of struggling with how to change existing infrastructure.
Jennifer, how do we find out more? Follow online, continue to learn about R0.
Yeah, you can go to r0.com. There's a suite of information available about all of our products, hardware and software. Also, feel free to reach out to anyone on the team through LinkedIn. You can definitely link into me, send me a message. Would love to hear how we can all together, you know, have our boats rise and solve the emerging problems, or not even emerging problems. Like, we all know that global warming has been here for a long time, and how we can do it together.
Jennifer, thank you so very much for being with us and what you are doing at the macro level to make our buildings better. And we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, I loved it. Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll be right back. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. Very excited to welcome back to the show our good friend Wayne Elliott. All you loyal listeners know that Wayne and I have been writing a book about environmentalism and the fact that entrepreneurs are going to save the world from all of these catastrophic climate change issues. We are going to jump now in the middle of an interview that I am with talking to Wayne. He's talking about a disaster that they have at their battery recycling factory.
A stainless conveyor broke underneath the hammer mill, and it was 3 months to replace it. And another conveyor, screw conveyor that we'd put to drag the wet lead out and put it on this floor, this heated floor. We'd put a boiler in and heated floor to dry the lead out. It twisted off the wall at lunchtime. The fellas forgot to shut it down, and the lead piled up underneath it, and it twisted itself right off its moorings. And that night, my sister and the two fellas that were running the company, I said, "Do you want to just quit the lead business?" And it was like I took a ton off every one of their shoulders right then and there. So we did. We quit that night, and we quit that day. And started to focus on the other battery types. We in-house, we built several different machines to break up these little consumer batteries, the double A's, the triple A's, the D's and C's. And that was quite a challenge. And we ended up developing the process that we ended up with, which was the black mass, the guts of those alkaline batteries, were treated and used as a micronutrient additive to grow corn for ethanol in the United States. And to this day, that's happening. And for every, they put 30 pounds of this black mass, they mix it, the fertilizer companies have a process, they mix it with fertilizer, and with their fertilizer, and with 30 pounds of it on an acre, they were getting 20 extra bushels of corn. So there was great demand for it. We always were able to sell every ton that we produced. And in fact, they wanted a lot more and we, you know, we could only produce what we could produce. All the while, this outfit called Call to Recycle, they're in the United States and Canada, and they are the producer responsibility organization that works for, if you will, Duracell, Energizer, Panasonic, Rayovac, and about 100 other battery manufacturers. And they put up a front that they're great recyclers and interested in recycling, but they've fought it every step of the way. California tried to legislate battery recycling 4 different times till they finally got it passed. And it was this group that was always the resistance. To this day, out of your 51 states in the United States, I believe there are 4 only that have legislated battery recycling. And during COVID, the state of California, 35 people came up to our plant. This was during COVID. Included a U.S. senator from California, and I believe a congressman. I wasn't there myself. The president of our battery company was there, James. And they came up to meet with us, scour through records, see the plant, just to prove they'd been told there was no legitimate alkaline battery recycling and that they just shouldn't legislate it because there's no process that makes any products. Well, of course, in a visit to our plant, they satisfied themselves that that wasn't true. There was a process, an excellent process, best demonstrated technology in the world process, clean process, negative carbon footprint. And then they went back to California and put the legislation in place. Now, again, the way these other birds dragged their feet, that won't start until 2026. Why, I don't know. Why it didn't start the next day, I don't know. But they ended up with a 4-year timeline before it had to start. So it'll start in 2026. That's a big deal. There's a lot of people in California. And we were anxious for that, waiting for years for more states to legislate it. So finally, California did. But about 3 years ago, just about to the day, they breached our contract and set us up truthfully and breached our contract and canceled our contract. And
who breached we continued the contract, on Wayne? For
Call to Recycle, okay. The so-called battery recycling gurus who are exactly the opposite of that. They don't want to recycle a pound is what they want. They've been boasting for years how they've collected 10 million pounds of rechargeables a year. Well, that's like the flea on the elephant, you know what. They've never wanted to do the alkaline batteries, which are about 85% of all consumer batteries. So they wanted nothing to do with that. And of the programs they have around the world, there are no two the same. They're all different programs. Whatever they can grind out of a contractor, they do. We didn't get a price increase for 15 years on any of our fees, collecting, sorting, recycling. There was no increase in price for 15 years. And to this day, well, I'm fast forwarding a little bit, but to this day, they, since we sold the assets of the company and E360, a BlackRock company, took them over, Call to Recycle has offered something like a third of what they were paying us. So impossible. You can't make ends meet. You can't even collect them, the batteries, much less sort them and recycle them for what they're offering. And anyhow, we carried on without their contract. And of course, no one was paying us fees for collecting, sorting, recycling. And so we lost many millions of dollars in that 18 or 19 months. And to this day, there is no, as far as I know now, there is no deal still. And the company that bought us is doing all the work with no fees, just piling up the credits that they're due to be paid for. And so it's a shame that if it wasn't for these people's resistance, just what we achieved in Ontario, which was the best record in the world, we collected up to 54% of all consumer batteries sold in Ontario. We built our collections. We had programs with schools, with companies. We did drives. Cities would have their collection times. They would put special containers out to go with the garbage and recycling. We're in the Guinness World Book of Records with the city of Durham for collecting the most batteries in a 24-hour period. It was just a tremendous effort to increase collections. We had a contest in the Ontario grade schools, and the school that collected the most got $10,000, and they could buy computers for the children, things like that. And then we had prizes down to, the sixth or seventh best. And that was very successful. But we weren't being paid our fees these last almost 2 years. So we ended up, we did file suit against them. I'm sure the way our court system works, that'll be 10 years. And they're sure in no rush because they can't win. They will lose. I think it's criminal. If you and I did this, defrauding the public, they charge the public in Ontario for every battery bought, Jim. The public pays a recycling fee. In the case of the alkalines, I believe it's 5 cents per battery. And I went out and bought, I actually had my office staff buy 8 or 10 packs of double A's. And of course, on each bill, they sell them generally in packs of four. On each bill, there was a 20 cent charge that went up to 24 cents, 6 cents a battery. But it was when I had them do it, it was 20 cents, so 5 cents per cell. And they didn't all call it the same thing. In fact, only one retailer called it an eco or a recycling fee. The others just had their own codes in there, I'm sure, for their own computer and accounting systems. But there it was on every one. So they're collecting this money from Ontario residents and not spending it on recycling. So in my view, that's defrauding the public and then willfully polluting. We went from our best was 54% of all batteries sold in Ontario were collected and recycled. And the first year that they operated without us, it dropped to 12%. Well, the other thousands of tons in the province of Ontario went to unprotected municipal landfills and people's kitchen catchers and however else they throw their trash out. And, you know, it's in North America, we've been burying 250,000 tons a year for decades. These little poison pills have been going into unprotected municipal landfills with your municipal household garbage. So, you know, it's just a shame. Once again, big corporations can get away with things that individuals and smaller companies would never get away with. The government has been very lax, keeps threatening them, threatens fines, and as far as I know, to this day has done nothing but threaten them. And I'm sure if they levied fines, which would be against each manufacturer for not meeting its targets, legislated targets, they would appeal that. The government wouldn't recharge them, although they could. They could charge them every day, let the fines pile up. But the government won't, and that will just delay things another, I don't know, 5 years. Until that gets to court, if it ever gets to court. And it's just hard to believe they can get away with this in this day and age. We had to sell and throw in the towel ourselves because we couldn't continue to lose the millions of dollars any longer. And so, I mean, I hope the BlackRock company has some success with this call to recycle, which they should change their name. Really, they have changed their name over the last 40 years as they've resisted battery recycling around the world. They've changed their name, I think, 3 or 4 times. And it's in my opinion, it's criminal. And the beat goes on. So, you know, as they say, the E360, the BlackRock company, is sure doing its best. It's carrying on the same thing we were doing and just building millions and millions of dollars in credits for recycling these batteries and not being paid. And yet the public is paying for every single battery to be recycled. So it's kind of an ugly story. It's one of corporate greed and criminal behavior.
Yes. How many millions of dollars do you think you spent on that throughout all of the 20 years, Wayne?
Oh, boy. I never really wanted to know that figure. I really mean that. We were recycling ships and open scrap metal yards, and we would continue to finance that business. But if you counted our losses the last 18 months. I guess $10 million. $10 million over the years. It sure was stubborn. Looking back, I wished I had quit many, many years ago and instead dedicated the time and money and effort and good people to something else, you know. It was a very tough 2 years going through that, where it was just a blatant contract breach. They did it because they could do it. And I don't even think they worried about getting away with it or not. In the meantime, their plan was to kill collections and turn the clock back 40 years. And to this day, you have four or five states. The first ones to approve it were your smallest states, Vermont, Connecticut, and I believe Michigan did, and now California has, which is meaningful. New York put in a program, and then the Auditor General of New York criticized both Call to Recycle and his own people, his own agency, for not doing a better job. But it's really hard to do a good job with those characters running the program. You know, just constant hurdles, that they put in front, and they don't pay enough, and argue over everything. It's just, it's a shame. They shouldn't get away with it. You know, if they weren't who they were, who they are, they wouldn't get away with it. If they were regular guys, smaller guys like you and I, they'd be in jail. So that's a, I've got some real sour grapes over that business after 39 years for it to end like that. And in my opinion, it's criminal in more ways than one.
I mean, I agree with you.
I hate these people for what they do. I don't know how they can be proud of themselves making a living like that. You might as well get a gun and start robbing old ladies' purses. Really, it's disgusting what they do.
I would agree with that. And do you think BlackRock anticipates changing the situation? Do you think with their political power, they'll be able to make some differences?
Well, you know, Jim, it's hard to say. They're BlackRock and E360 have gone big into the tire recycling business, and they're facing challenges in that, in those that area of their business for the tire stewards, the tire manufacturers, the resistance. And they have, I know, many millions of dollars in credits that have not been paid for. So it's manufacturers' resistance to this. If you turn the clock way, way back, the grocers were the first to resist recycling and returning products, plastic, cardboard, and so forth. And their excuse was, we can't. We send the transport trucks out loaded daily. How can we take the waste or the recyclables in the same truck when we've yet to deliver more goods to the stores? So this worked for years for them. And the medical manufacturers, they resisted strongly. So all manufacturers have, in each category, have resisted this because it's work and it costs. But the whole point of these programs is for manufacturers to be responsible for the waste created from manufacturing their products, the end-of-life management of their products. Electronics manufacturers, same thing. The biggest recycling company in the world, Sims from Australia, just walked out of Ontario, left their mega million-dollar investment in electronics recycling over total frustration with the manufacturers that they were recycling for and the government that was doing such a poor job to legislate and force companies to do the right thing. So it's been a long, long story. And to date, the manufacturers have, if you're talking about money, they've certainly won thus far. Now, there's a lot of recycling going on, including electronics today, that is being funded by manufacturers. But the decades of resistance were really something where so much more went into our landfills that could have been recycled. You know, it's against the law to bury metal in most places because it is recyclable. When you recycle metal, you're conserving natural resources. When you manufacture metal from scrap, from recycled materials as opposed to virgin ore, there's an 80 to 85% energy savings. When you look at the pollution caused by mining, that is all avoided. The opposite happens when you take old goods, old tractors, vehicles, manufacturing scrap, and remelt it. And all metal is infinitely recyclable. So what's a ship today, or part of a ship, can be razor blades tomorrow, can be a Chevrolet the next, this next life, and metal telephone poles the next life. You know, it's infinitely recyclable. So metal should be outlawed from being buried. And, you know, the government could do a lot better job, in my opinion. I guess these companies have clout, Jim. They have thousands of employees. And the government has just been very slow to bring them to task. I mean, it's been, 3 years now, the Ontario government's been threatening these people. And as far as I know, nothing has happened yet. I really have nothing to do with it now, since we sold. And I know they sure did struggle the first year. It's just 1 year now since they took over and we sold, September 1st of last year. So it's hard slugging in that business. And I don't know what's going to happen in the end. I mean, you'd have to believe in the end that the smart thing, the proper thing, is going to happen. But if they had been as successful in the United States as we were in Ontario, you'd have hundreds of thousands of tons less with their hydrogen, darn, I can't even think what the chemical is now. It's the opposite of acid. It's caustic. I was going to say hydrogen peroxide, but that's not right. I just can't think of what the chemical's called this morning, but potassium hydroxide. And so it's caustic. It's like acid. And although these are called dry cell batteries, there isn't one of them that's dry. There is the potassium hydroxide inside. And that potassium, when we recycle the batteries, as E360 does now, that potassium is one of four micronutrients that is in the black mass that's added to the fertilizer to grow all this corn for ethanol. So, you know, there's a good end use for it. We had to prove all this. This call to recycle put us through paces you just can't believe year after year. And we continued to prove ourselves legitimate and selling this black mass. And, of course, the metal case was recycled 100%. So we got the highest recycling rate in the world out of our process as well. It was, I think it was 88% of the battery was recycled into a valuable, usable good. The 12% we didn't get recycled was the paper and plastic mix that's inside these batteries. And instead, it wasn't allowed to landfill anything. You couldn't landfill anything in this program in Ontario. So we shipped that to one of these waste-to-energy plants where they burn it to make electric power.
Right.
Burn it properly or safely to make electric energy. And that's what... So there wasn't an ounce of those tens of thousands of tons, not an ounce, went into a landfill.
That is amazing, Wayne. We need to wrap it up for the week. Unbelievable how fast 32 minutes can go. I appreciate it as always, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Okay, Jim. Thank you.
Have All right, drive one. Those last... Mile safely, Wayne. Get home safe.
Bet.
We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow on Friday. Be safe, everyone. Take care and go make $1 million by now.